And Radio Derb is on the air. Greetings, listeners, from your fervently genial host, John Derbyshire, this second weekend of April 2024. This is one of my pre-recorded podcasts. Next week's likewise. The second and third weeks of April this year, I shall be exceptionally busy, so I shall record them in the first week, before all the busyness overwhelms me. I have occasionally done this before under similar circumstances. But then, Derb, I hear you cry, how can you be commenting on current events? Well, I'm trusting to Providence that no natural catastrophe or political upheaval has transpired in between my recording this and your hearing it, and no war or plague has broken out. Trusting thus, I shall dig into the archives and give you Radio Derb segments from April's in previous years. This will be a trip down memory lane. To simplify the work of selection, in fact, all the segments in this podcast and the next are lifted from the third week of April in years gone by, from 2006 to 2023. So, here we go. The third week of April's past, as recorded by what I am guessing may be the longest continuously aired National Conservative podcast on the internet. Radio Derb started up in 2004, but it took a while to settle into a regular weekly schedule. The first time we aired on a third Friday in April was April 21st, 2006. The federal government wasn't as wildly irresponsible about illegal immigration back then as it has since become. But they weren't policing the issue with inflexible rigour either. Here's a roundup of the rest of the immigration news. Last week I gave you the sad story of two Englishmen trying to walk round the world, who got arrested for entering Siberia without the right documents. Just to update you on that, they were ordered to be deported, but are still there, pending an appeal. Probably nobody over there has much idea what to do, since this may well be the first recorded case of anyone trying to get into Siberia. Well, here's an even sadder immigration story, so get your hankies out. Francisco Javier Silva Serrano is a young man from Mexico who last year was caught posing as a student and living on the premises of a school in St. Paul, Minnesota. Serrano, who had entered the USA illegally, was ordered to be deported. Local sympathisers took up his case, however, and a St. Paul businessman bailed him out of jail and promised to support him. Alas, the businessman himself got in trouble with the law, has been shipped off to jail on a bribery charge, in fact, and a federal judge confirmed Silva Serrano's deportation order. The Cumbaya crowd, when they got through weeping, brought the young man a plane ticket and hugged him as he passed through the airport departure gate in January, bound for Mexico. Well, it seems young Francisco never got on the plane. Last month, he was arrested for burglary in Boston, after breaking into an apartment wielding a knife and fighting with the occupant. St. Paul's poster boy for tolerance of illegal immigration now looks set fair to enjoy another 2.5 years' residence in this country as a guest of Massachusetts Department of Correction. Now, I said this was a sad story, so why are you all smiling?
Ah!
As I record this on April 2nd, 2024, we are seeing regular reports of hunger, even starvation, in Cuba. Are our lefties still swooning over that country, as Michael Moore was in 2007?
Everybody's going to Cuba. First we hear that lefty movie maker, there's a pleonasm for you, lefty movie maker Michael Moore took ground zero responders, people made sick by working at the site, to Cuba for healthcare treatment in the Comey Islands hospitals, which, as any lefty will tell you, are far superior to America's. This was all filmed as part of Moore's latest documentary, titled Sicko, an attack on American drug companies and HMOs. To their great credit, several Ground Zero workers refused to go along with the stunt. Then we read that a group of students from a public, but selective, high school on the Upper West Side of Manhattan were taken on a spring break field trip to the communist paradise. The teacher who organized the trip, name of Nathan Turner, has, we are told, a classroom whose walls are adorned with posters of Cuban dictator Fidel Castro and Marxist revolutionary Che Guevara. Let me tell you something, reader. Any time a conservative like me uses the word communist, or refers to the horrors of Leninist or Stalinist or Maoist rule, folk on the left just howl with derision. Oh, that was ages ago, they say. That's all long behind us. Nobody supports that stuff anymore. Nobody's standing up for Stalin or Mao anymore. You are so behind the times, Derb. Well, if that's true, how come Marxist-Leninists like Fidel Castro and Che Guevara are still such heroes over on the left? If I'm flogging a dead horse, how come the horse just kicked out the brains of another dissident in Havana? Oh, but I forgot. They have universal free health care, so having your brains kicked out by a dead horse doesn't hurt so much, I guess.
The 2008 Summer Olympics were held in Peking. Did I take the opportunity to say rude things about the Chi-Coms? Of course I did.
Commentator Jack Cafferty over at CNN found himself on a sticky wicket this week after saying the following thing, quote, "I think our relationship with China has certainly changed. I think they are basically the same bunch of goons and thugs they've been for the last 50 years. End quote. It was obvious that Jack meant the Chi-Com government, but the masses took it personally, and poor Jack is being burned in effigy from Manchuria to Macau, from Shanghai to Sichuan. You read some of the news stories about this, though, and the impression comes on you that the Chinese are suffering from some kind of collective psychosis. Listen, this is from a Reuters report. Quote, "A Chinese primary school teacher and a beautician have filed a suit against CNN in New York over these remarks, which they say insulted the Chinese people. They are seeking $1.3 billion in compensation, $1 per person in China." Speaking in New York, Liang Shubing, she's the beautician, and Li Li Lan, that's the teacher, claimed that Cafferty's words insulted all Chinese people and, quote within a quote here, intentionally caused mental harm to them. End quote. Now, quite aside from the fact that if we had a government worth a damn, these two morons would have been on a plane back to China about 30 minutes after that news report appeared. Apart from that, just look at the psychology there. And it's not just these two Sino-nitwits either. Later in the same report, a CHICOM spokescommie tells us that Cafferty, quote, hurt China's feelings. Poor things. We hurt their feelings. This from a representative of the party that caused 30 million Chinese people to starve to death via agricultural policies of sensational stupidity. Perhaps it starved those 30 million people to death without hurting their feelings. Who knows? Perhaps it massacred all those Tibetan monks and nuns without hurting their feelings either. Perhaps it's beating up on Falun Gong demonstrators without hurting their feelings. What a nation of crybabies. You're going to hear a lot more whining like this as the Summer Olympics go down the tubes. It'll be a regular whine-o-rama of self-pity and self-justification by people who simply cannot imagine that their nation could ever do or ever have done anything wrong. Perhaps we could make it an Olympic event. You know, the 1,000 meters whine, the triple emotional blackmail, something like that. Memo to the world's most insecure people. Get yourselves a civilized, rational form of government, and then there will be no more issues between you and us than there are between Japan and us, or Australia and us, or Sweden and us. Or stick with this bunch of goons and thugs you've got in charge there, and sooner or later things will end in tears. Real tears. The name Janet Napolitano mean anything? She is still drawing a government salary, I see, as a member of Joe Biden's Intelligence Advisory Board. Can she do as much harm to the nation there as she did when she was Barack Obama's first Secretary for Homeland Security? Let's hope not.
Our Secretary for Homeland Security, Janet Napolitano, has hit the ground running. She is determined to make the homeland secure and is launching initiatives all over the place. To begin with, Secretary Napolitano has identified the two great looming threats to our security: Canada and our own conservatives. On the first of those threats, she told a symposium at the Brookings Institution last month that the administration will take steps to make the US-Canadian border more secure. From June 1st this year, Canadians will have to show a passport when entering the USA. This is great news for us immigration restrictionists. It offers the hope that the flow of Canadian high school dropouts into our northern states will at last be stanched. American citizens in Montana and Minnesota will no longer have to wait in line at the hospital emergency desk behind people named Mackenzie and Tweed, using it as their primary healthcare service. The school teachers in Washington State will no longer have to waste their time dealing with kids who think that the last letter of the alphabet is called Z. Loggers in Maine will no longer have their wages undercut by illegal Quebecois labour. The streets of Fargo and Boise will no longer be terrorised by gangs like the dreaded Moose Marauders, or the even more dreaded MS-13. MS, of course, standing for Manitoba and Saskatchewan, and 13 being the average number of years you have to wait for hip replacement surgery in Toronto. Perhaps we'll even be able to dispense with those annoying phone menus that tell you to press 2 if you prefer to hear the word about pronounced aboot. Yes, this may be the first step to reclaiming America from invading hordes speaking incomprehensible languages. And then there is the menace of conservatism. Oh boy, this needs a Radio Derb segment all to itself.
In the second year of Obama's administration, Arizona tried to make illegal immigration illegal by passing Senate Bill 2070. The pro-crime lobbies were, of course, outraged.
Tuesday this week, the Arizona State Legislature passed a law making it a misdemeanor for non-citizens to be in the state without valid immigration documents, and requiring local police forces to check people's immigration status on reasonable suspicion. The governor is expected to sign the bill. Said the Los Angeles Times, quote, "Immigrant rights groups were horrified and contended that Arizona would be transformed into a police state," end quote. Huh, immigrant rights groups, huh? Well, let's see. I'm an immigrant. My wife is an immigrant, and half our friends are immigrants. So an immigrant rights group is something I should be keenly interested in. Why do I suspect that these immigrant rights groups are not the least bit interested in me or my rights? Well, probably because I'm aware that these so-called immigrant rights groups are just fronts for the cheap labour lobbies, Mexican revanchists, love-the-world sentimentalists, and the Democratic Party, which, finding the US population insufficiently receptive to its policies, is determined to import a new population. As for Arizona becoming a police state, that's an insult to our police officers, and an even more egregious insult to the poor devils who live in real police states. Places like Cuba, or China, or Zimbabwe, where the authorities can take your property, your liberty, even your life, without answering to courts of law. If I lived in Arizona, I'd want it to be a police state, for lawbreakers. That's why we have police. That's what they're for, to enforce the law. Nobody in Arizona who's not breaking the law need fear the police. In any case, it's not likely this Arizona law will survive legal challenges, any more than California's Proposition 187 did. The federal government will not enforce the people's laws. And if frustrated state governments try to, federal judges slap them down. Our rulers of both parties have determined that unlimited, unmonitored immigration from Mexico is what they want. And they don't care what we think about it.
In April 2011, we were starting to think seriously about the following year's election. What have we got? I asked at the end of segment 3. Here is segment 4.
Donald Trump, that's what. Yes. The Donald has thrown his hair into the ring. At this point, Trump isn't actually technically running. Exploring a presidential bid is the media phrase, which I guess means dipping a toe in the water. He says he'll come to a definite decision by June. He might run independent, but says he'd prefer the Republican nomination if he can get it. So, what are we to make of the Donald and his prospects? Well, first off, the prospects aren't negligible. Numbers released Tuesday by a very respectable polling outfit showed Trump tied with Mike Huckabee as the 2012 favourites among Republican voters. The professional politicians were quick to poo-poo the poll, pointing out that these guys both have high name recognition because of popular TV shows. And when voters drag themselves away from TV and concentrate their minds on their citizenly duties, they'll soon realise how much wiser and more competent are the sober, experienced professionals in our legislators' and governors' mansions. I don't know about that. The negativity that I feel towards our political classes, and which I can barely keep under control in these broadcasts, is very widely shared. A lot of it is unfair, as I keep telling you. The polls are doing what we want them to do, or what some powerful lobby that we have failed to restrain wants them to do. Human beings must blame somebody, though, and blaming one's own sweet self has never been a thing that we're much inclined to do. So, right now, we're seriously down on the polls. Here comes a non-poll, Donald Trump, and naturally he puts a smile on our face. Hey, he might do something different. And he might. In a TV interview this Monday, Trump picked out our recent trade agreement with South Korea, saying it was a, quote, joke, with insufficient benefits for the United States. Quote from the Donald. We go over there, we protect them with our ships. Did anyone pay us for this? No. End quote. Hold up there a minute, Donald. You mean to say you'd conduct US foreign policy in our own national interest, not in the interests of foreigners? Now that's radical. If the Donald can have thoughts as radical as that, maybe he could even have a thought as radical as this. Since South Korea has a vigorous modern economy and a huge, well-trained and well-equipped modern military, while North Korea has no economy and a military of half-starved peasants manning patched-up Soviet-era equipment, maybe the South Koreans should take care of their own national defence, and we should withdraw the 30,000 troops we have stationed there. Once you start to have subversive thoughts like that, others come thick and fast. If we don't need those 30,000 troops in South Korea, then, hey, maybe we don't need the 36,000 we've got stationed in Japan either. It may even be, and you might want to sit down for this one, this is way out radical, it may even be that we don't need to keep 52,000 troops stationed in Germany, or 10,000 in Italy, or 9,000 in Britain. It's real nice for those countries to have us protecting them, but how is it good for us? Once you get into this frame of mind, in fact, the frame of mind that says US policy should be conducted in the interest of US citizens and of no one else on earth, then you can't hold back the crazy ideas. They just keep coming. Maybe we should stop importing cheap foreign labour to undercut American workers. Maybe a nation of 300 million plus, spending more per capita on education than any other country ever has in all of human history, maybe we could produce all the computer programmers we need and drop the whole H-1B visa system. Maybe African countries, after half a century of independence, could run their own AIDS prevention programs instead of us spending billions of dollars teaching them how to use condoms. Maybe we should tell Mexico to take steps to improve opportunities for its poorest citizens instead of shoving them across the border to us. Maybe we should tell China to float its currency like a grown-up nation, or else we'll stick a suitable tariff on Chinese imports. Hey, the Donald actually did say that one. Our politics is very formalised and stylised, though, and a guy who hasn't mastered the kabuki arts and the proper diction, the words and the gestures we've come to expect, is attacking our comfort level. Trump hasn't helped himself by signing up with the birthers. There is no sound reason to think that Obama was born anywhere other than Hawaii. And we've all figured out by now that his caginess about his precise birth documentation is due to the big Sharpie checkmark against the word Muslim that we'd see. Since nobody thinks that Obama is a pious Muslim, or a pious anything, nobody much cares about this. We got much more important things to worry about. If Donald would drop the Bertha stuff and just hammer on that theme he raised Monday, the theme of conducting US policy in the interests of US citizens, I say he'd be in with a chance. At least he's lived in the real world, the world of business, of hiring and firing, of keeping the government at bay and creating wealth. As background for a chief executive, that beats community organising by a mile in my book. And if Trump is the GOP candidate, I'll gladly vote for him. What if he runs as an independent, though? I'll get back to you on that.
In April 2012, there was a slight disturbance in the space-time continuum, with the result that there was no podcast in the third week of that month. By April 2013, I was firmly back in the saddle, ripping open and exposing the refugee rackets. Working for VDare.com, which is an immigration restrictionist website, I do a lot of writing about immigration. To do a lot of writing, you have to do a lot of reading. One of my favourite websites for immigration topics is Anne Corcoran's Refugee Resettlement Watch. It's a real eye-opener. If you thought refugees are pitiable, half-starved wretches fleeing persecution with their meagre possessions in cloth bundles, read Anne's site and get yourself an education in the refugee scam. There are, of course, some genuine refugees, but they are atypical. To attain refugee status, you need a story, and your story needs to be believed by the people processing refugees at the front end. It's in the nature of things, though, that these stories are impossible to check. So refugees are mostly third worlders who've figured this out, who have enough chutzpah to keep telling the same lies over and over to the processing officers, and who want to live in the West. Your poster child here is Nafissatou Diallo, the hotel maid who accused Dominique Strauss-Kahn, head of the International Monetary Fund, of raping her 2 years ago. That turned out to be a pack of lies. So did Ms. Diallo's story about being gang-raped in her native country of Guinea, West Africa. A story that got her a refugee visa to live in the USA. Then there is reunification of families. Once a refugee is in the USA, they can petition for relatives to come in. This aspect of immigration policy was so addled with fraud, it was actually suspended for several African countries in 2008, when DNA testing showed that most of the relatives tested were not actually related. The program is still partially suspended. Lobbying to keep these scams going in the USA are the so-called VOLAGs, or voluntary agencies. These have impressive and heartwarming names like Episcopal Migration Ministries, Hebrew Immigrant Aid Society, Lutheran Immigration and Refugee Services, and US Conference of Catholic Bishops. Pretty holy, eh? Don't be fooled. These VOLAGs get a cash grant from the State Department for each refugee they settle. This is big business. The Lutherans, for example, got $8.5 million of your money and mine in 2011. And no, they don't spend much on actual resettlement. Once refugees are here, the VOLAGs hand them off to the welfare agencies as fast as they can. This seems to be what happened to the Tsarnaevs, who were on welfare most of the time. That's the background to the Tsarnaev family being in the USA. The father and his younger son, who was then aged 8, first came to the United States legally in April 2002 on 90-day tourist visas. Once here, the father applied for political asylum, claiming he feared deadly persecution based on his ties to Chechnya. Now, for a Russian to get a US tourist visa is not easy. You have to prove you're employed and fairly well off, so that you'll return after visiting the States. Furthermore, the dad was actually born and raised in Kyrgyzstan, then a Soviet republic, but now an independent state. He has dual citizenship, so if he was persecuted in Russia, he had another country to go to. Tsarnaev Sr. didn't have any known ties to Chechnya anyway, other than his ancestry, and the fighting there had died down by that point. What we have here is an extremely gullible asylum officer in the immigration office, one who should be named and fired. It's all too typical, though. 12 years after 9/11, the USA is as wide open as ever. Wide open to illegals strolling across the border. Wide open to bogus refugees. Wide open to so many foreign students there's barely room for American kids in some of our colleges. Wide open, wide open. This isn't a country. It's a hotel. Here's me venting in 2014, venting over a question that I have vented over periodically all through my career as an opinionator. The question comes at the very end. This story is about a homicide that took place in Indianapolis, April 1st. The victim was a young man named Nathan Trapuzzano, a computer programmer. Mr. Trapuzzano would have been 25 years old, May 17th. He was coming up to his first wedding anniversary, May 11th, and he and his wife Jennifer were expecting their first child, due May 7th. A baby girl they already named Cecilia. Trapuzzano was shot in the abdomen while out for his regular early morning walk. He was found lying in the parking lot of a tire store, still alive, wearing just his tracksuit bottom. He'd been stripped of his sneakers, sweater and t-shirt. He was rushed to hospital but died under surgery. Security footage shows Trapuzzano being followed by two men. One of them accosts him and takes him into the parking lot while the other stands lookout. Mr. Trapuzzano and his wife were devout Roman Catholics. At the April 5th funeral service, their priest, Father Christopher Roberts, told the congregation of several hundred that they should forgive Nathan's killers, adding, quote, "I have no doubt that Nathan forgave his murderers. That was the type of man that I knew him to be." End quote. April the 8th, prosecutors announced they charged one Simeon Adams with the shooting. Mr. Adams also has a life milestone coming up in May. He'll be 17 years old on May the 3rd. It will have been a busy 17 years. Adams has a long rap sheet showing handgun violations, marijuana possession, theft, auto theft, burglary and resisting arrest. It appears Adams shot a different person, a teenager named Eric Douglas, 2 days before he shot Nathan Trapuzzano, after Douglas accidentally bumped into him. Douglas's wounds were not fatal. That same day, April 8th, on a Facebook page, the widow, Jennifer Trapasano, expressed herself as follows, quote, "Today has been extra rough. It's been 1 week, and I still can't comprehend that this is all real. The police have reported the suspect of my husband's murder was only 16. Oh, how my already wounded heart aches to hear this. Nate always said one of the greatest crimes in the world today is how many babies grow up without their father. I don't know this man's circumstances, but it hurts to hear that such a young man could turn to such violence. Please pray for his conversion." End quote. Simeon Adams is black. So is his accomplice in the Trapasano shooting, Martez McGraw. At least I'm assuming that's the other defendant seen in the TV news clip with Adams coming into the courthouse for arraignment on April 10th. The two of them seem to be joking together. Adams is smiling broadly. Now, I need to vent very briefly here. I shall try to be sensitive. I don't want to give offence to anyone, though I suppose I shall. Poor Jennifer Trapasano, in the state of grief and shock she must be in, should not be begrudged any consolation she can find, wherever she can find it. Presumably the congregation at that funeral service found the priest's words acceptable. At any rate, there were no reports of anyone storming out of the church in disgust, although I have to believe that some of the mourners must have felt like doing so, but restrained themselves out of respect for the widow's feelings. For myself, though, I have to say, this talk of forgiveness sticks in my throat. I said I was going to vent. I said it would be brief, and I said it might give offence, so cover your ears if you offend easy. Ready for the vent? Here goes. What the hell is wrong with white people? In April 2015, Bill de Blasio was well into his second year as mayor of New York City. It looked as though he was going to try for a presidential run in the following year's election. Yes, among the Democrats working Iowa last week was New York City's communist mayor, Bill de Blasio. Given that Iowa's an agricultural state, and that communism and agriculture are in somewhat the same relation to each other as concentrated sulfuric acid and tissue paper, this is a bit odd. Let's just reprise some history here. Stalin's famine in the early 1930s, 6 million dead. Mao Zedong's famine in the early 1960s, 30 million dead. Kim Jong-il's famine in the early 1990s, 500,000 or 600,000 dead. Hey, did you notice the arithmetic progression there? 30s, 60s, 90s. That's one commie famine every 30 years. So the next one's due in the early 2020s. In the de Blasio presidency, perhaps. How about Fidel Castro's Cuba, which comrade de Blasio and his wife admired so much they evaded a State Department travel ban to take their honeymoon there? Was there a Fidel Castro famine? There certainly was. What kind of commie would Castro be if he didn't manage a single famine? The 6 years after the Soviet Union suspended food support to Cuba, that was the years 1990 to 1995, are referred to delicately by the Cuban authorities, when they have to refer to them, as the special period. Quote from a National Institutes of Health report, quote,
During this period, Cubans essentially experienced a famine. Adults had an average daily protein intake of 15 to 20 grams and lost an average of 5% to 25% of their body weight. Priority was given to the elite classes and the military. In Cuba, the death rate among the elderly increased by 20% from 1982 to 1993. 30,000 Cubans fled the country, and thousands of these emigrants drowned or were killed by sharks in the Gulf of Mexico. End quote. I mentioned de Blasio and his missus taking their honeymoon in Cuba. When was that? In 1994, according to the New York Post. So, right there at the height of the special period. No doubt the de Blasios reduced their daily protein intake in solidarity with the common people of Cuba. No doubt when the de Blasios met members of the elite classes, Cuba's 1% as it were, no doubt they scolded them angrily for feeding their faces while ordinary people were going hungry. Of course they did. I'm sure they did. So anyway, there's de Blasio in Iowa last week, possibly scouting out where the big kulaks live, so he'll know where to send the roundup squads in 2021. Who knows? What did he talk to the Iowans about? Income inequality, that's what. Quote from CBS Newswire, April 16th, quote, de Blasio said the daily struggle of hard-working people to keep their heads above water is a national problem that requires a national commitment to solve it. Among his proposals to address income inequality were raising the minimum wage and offering paid sick leave to all workers. End quote. That's it. We need to raise the price of labour. Yes, that should help working people to keep their jobs in an age of galloping automation. Setting aside the opportunity to scope out Midwestern kulaks for dispossession, de Blasio was probably glad to be away from New York. The announcement that he'd be in Iowa ahead of Hillary had not been received well by the Clinton people. What was he trying to do, they grumbled, upstage her? Disgruntlement turned to fury on Sunday, the day Hillary announced the official start of her campaign. That very morning, on Meet the Press, de Blasio politely declined to endorse Hillary. He said he couldn't endorse her until he saw a, quote, actual vision of where she wants to go. That sounds somewhat odd. De Blasio has known the Clintons personally since 1997, when President Bill Clinton tapped him to be a regional director at HUD, the Federal Housing Bureaucracy. De Blasio was the manager of Hillary Clinton's Senate campaign in 2000. When he ran for mayor of New York in 2013, Hillary campaigned and fundraised for him. And after he won that race, Bill Clinton swore him in as mayor. That's 18 years of chowing down with the Clintons. And de Blasio doesn't have any idea what Hillary's politics are? His non-endorsement did not go down well with the party bosses in New York. It is a moral imperative for people who are leaders of the progressive movement to support her, said Bigfoot Democrat Robert Zimmerman. On top of that, de Blasio was booed by fans when he showed up at the New York Mets season opener on Monday. So, with one thing and another, New York's mayor was probably glad to be out in the vast wastelands west of the Hudson River, scoping out locations for collective farms. What's really going on here is that the hard left of the Democratic Party doesn't much like Mrs. Clinton. They fear she'll govern from the squishy centre-left, as her husband did, after the 1994 Gingrich Revolution. Conceding abominations like welfare reform and the Defense of Marriage Act. Some of these far-left activists believe she's inevitable as the party's nominee, and they just want to push her to the left. Others think she's beatable for the nomination by a candidate further to the left, de Blasio himself possibly, or more likely Warren or O'Malley, with de Blasio as an accelerant. It'll be interesting to see how nasty the infighting gets. Speaking personally, if open warfare breaks out on the left, I'd put my money on Hillary. Mainly because so many people already have put their money on Hillary. Money isn't the only thing in politics, as Eric Cantor could explain to you. But it gives you a big start, and anyone who can persuade people to pay her $200,000 for a speech full of gassy platitudes delivered in a condescending monotone knows stuff about raising money. The hard left knows a thing or two also, though, so we shall see. This is shaping up as great political entertainment. I wouldn't venture to call the Democratic nomination at this point, but in the immediately upcoming tussle between Hillary and the ideological purists, I say Hillary can take them easily. In fact, if Bill de Blasio were to end up in Mexico City with an ice pick in his head, I wouldn't be at all surprised.
The April 15th podcast in 2016 had words to say about Britain's Queen Elizabeth II, whose 90th birthday was imminent.
Thursday next week, April 21st, marks the 90th birthday of Elizabeth, Queen of England, and sundry other places. I offer Her Majesty my congratulations and best wishes. Small R Republicans should forgive me. Elizabeth's been part of the furniture of the world for almost as long as I can remember. Her coronation, the day before my 8th birthday, was the first public event to impinge on my consciousness. I have a sentimental attachment. Also a political one of sorts. Constitutional monarchy is a pretty good system, as systems go. There's been some talk of the English monarchy being scrapped after Elizabeth passes, but I doubt that. I suspect it'll be scaled down considerably, but a state needs a head of state, and to have one standing outside the party political system gives you a stability that you don't see in presidential republics. The trouble with constitutional monarchy is that its legitimacy rests to some degree on the monarch's personality. Too much misbehaviour in the palace discredits the whole business. From that point of view, Elizabeth's been a perfect monarch. Sober, dutiful, a model of bourgeois propriety. There is a dissident right case against Elizabeth. She has a strong emotional attachment to the old British Empire, nowadays the British Commonwealth, and her influence likely contributed in some measure to the catastrophic flooding of Britain by Third World immigrants during her reign. Whether she constitutionally could have done anything to prevent that, I don't know, but it would have been against her inclinations. In that regard, the First World's other major constitutional monarchy, Japan, has managed its affairs much better, keeping itself resolutely Japanese in the face of various economic and demographic problems. What accounts for the difference? Japan and Britain are both island nations, both constitutional monarchies, both old imperial powers. You can argue that Britain was better at imperialism, with less tendency to run amok and massacre people, but the Brits did some of that. While as peacetime imperialists, in Taiwan and Korea and Manchuria, for example, you need to discard some Chinese communist propaganda here. As peacetime imperialists, the Japanese were mostly constructive and well-behaved. Both imperialisms, when not stressed by war, both of them had similar attitudes to their subject peoples, mainly racial paternalism. The real differences here in social outcomes these past few decades, the real difference between these two island nations under constitutional monarchy, is in the character of their people. The Brits opened wide their borders, and the Japs kept theirs tight closed, because of different popular attitudes towards society and the outside world. I'm going to circle back round to that point after a detour through a different issue. That has taken us from 2006 to 2016. Our trip down memory lane will continue in next week's podcast. In the meantime, as always, thank you for listening, for your emails and your kind donations. I am, as always, way behind with email, this month even further behind than usual, so please bear with me. Here is Gracie Fields to sing us out. There will be more from Radio Derb next week.